Welcome to 2 Men in the Middle, Democracy in Flyover Country. From here, we'll discuss today's topics from a Midwestern perspective with our boots firmly on the ground in a red state. I am Mike McCammon.
I am Craig Huey.
This week's topics, Comey, Cohn, and some odds and ends. And I kind of want to almost like start this off with my low energy, but I thought I had to kind of like bring it. I was only like, welcome to 2 Men in the Middle. I was thinking about, hey, you know, welcome to like 2 Men in the Middle. Like, I mean, I just, oh my God, I'm so tired.
So we've talked about this before that this is a podcast where Mike is sitting again. And the last time you sat on the podcast, literally you almost stopped mid-sentence and just nodded off.
Exactly. So, I'm a big fan of the 80-20 rule, and I'm just going to warn all listeners this week, you're going to get 80% Ugly and 20% Mike. I just want to let you know that because I have barely enough energy to get 20% out.
But let's get a campaign update then. I mean, because that's we've talked about running for Congress is hard.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, is it hard? I mean, it does consume your life. You know, you basically every conversation you have is like, you know, you always joke about you're never supposed to talk about like religion and politics with your friends. This is politics 7x24.
So not only are you talking all the time, you're having the most exhausting type of conversations the time.
It's fun, but you know, you never know what policy questions someone's going to have, and you can't know everything, of course. I really enjoy it. The thing I've been doing that I know is different from the candidates that are running in this field is I'm spending a lot of time meeting with people in the community, and you know, you begin to see a really different perspective if you do that.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I'm also noticing is that like I'm able to connect. I'm beginning to in my mind connect dots that people just cannot connect if they're not out there talking to people because they basically like watch whatever news program or listen to whatever podcast like this one or something, and they feel like they're getting like the whole perspective, and they're not. They're getting a distilled version of something that in a lot of cases might be designed to kind of manipulate you to think something as opposed to actually going there. I mean, I'll tell a quick story. So I was at one of the local high schools in Wyandotte County, which is a much more economically disadvantaged, you know, area of our district. But, you know, when you're sitting in the classroom with the kids,
you don't feel it.
They're just kids, man. They're just kids. Yeah. Just like, and I'm just sitting there thinking, okay, the high school I went to in Wichita, you know, it's not the same demographic profile, but I'm from south part of Wichita, so it's kind of a not very, you know, it's a working class neighborhood, just like a lot of these kids. And they're just kids. And like the epiphany I had yesterday was that, you know, normally when you talk about schools and you're running for a federal office, the first thing you say is, you know, well, the kind of the conversation goes around to, well, it's kind of more of a state issue because they do the funding.
Yeah.
And then you kind of talk about like a libertarian view that, you know, federal government should not make not require mandates without giving money. It's kind of another place you go. And then someone wants to engage you in a Betsy DeVos conversation, how, you know, much of a moron she is.
Yeah.
So, and that's pretty much like ABC of like talking about education for a federal office. But I was in the schools yesterday, and I also went to an elementary school, and I was just like sitting there thinking, you know, actually schools are a federal issue, and there's actually a lot of things the federal government could do to make it better, but it's very indirect. So it's not about necessarily getting more money to the schools, which they need, and the state's responsible for doing that. But it's about like providing an environment that these families live in, so when the kids go to school, they can focus on school. I heard stories. Like I heard a story about a family whose father is being detained by ICE.
Yeah,
and like he's been in jail for 2 months pending deportation for basically like a speeding ticket and like a paperwork violation.
So paperwork violation made him here illegal. He gets picked up on a minor traffic accident, no
and
felony
he's facing
record,
deportation.
And now he's facing deportation.
The school is trying to triage how do we keep this kid in school because it's a bright kid.
Yeah,
and it's like okay. That's right. Like the shit that's going on at home, you bring to school.
Yeah.
It's the same thing that happens. I mean, and in a way, and here's why it's kind of this very strange nuance is that like we all bring our personal life to our day life. So if you're having shit time at home, you bring it to work.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're in the working place, but see like work is different. Work can say like, if you're not performing well, we'll just get rid of you.
Absolutely.
And I don't care what shit you got going on at home.
Yeah.
I mean, most companies do, but they do care about it. But in general, it's like, okay, at the end of the day, we're like paying you for performance. You're not performing, you're gone.
Yeah.
I don't care what kind of shit show you got going on at home. But like public schools can't do that. They are federally mandated to take every kid that walks in that front door. Well, so they got to deal with all that shit.
Yeah.
And you know, I was standing in front of the elementary school yesterday, and I know this is going to sound stupid and corny, but I'm looking at the American flag, you know, flying at that school, and I'm thinking, you know, that's what this place is about. It's about giving people a fair opportunity to make it good, you know, make it better in their life. And a school, like that's the front lines where that happens.
You've made that point multiple times that the police and schools are really the front line. And they're the folks that can't turn anybody away.
Right.
They've got to, the situation that you just described, they've got to find a way to deal with that. And in some ways, they're the least prepared, least funded, and least capable of doing
that. Capable is a little bit tough, but I would say they are definitely under-resourced.
I'll say, yeah.
Given the scope of the challenges.
By capable, I mean they don't have the resources.
Yes. Yeah.
And again, I think of like a school. Public schools are designed to, it's a march forward at all time. You're trying to push as many kids as you can through the standardized tests, through the standardized curriculum to get them to the next phase. You get one kid that requires some type of special attention because of like the situation that you described, the whole march forward, it puts a strain on everything. And there's just no sideway, it seems like, to say, these are special cases, this is how we deal with them.
And I'm beginning to think that, oh, and by the way, I kind of the word I got was that in many of these schools and in these rougher part of towns, even the one I was in earlier this week, I'm being told that, and I believe, you know, why I don't have any reason not to believe that, you know, if you look at kind of like all the metrics for, you know, what is going to make a successful student, you know, they're basically like all the odds are stacked against them.
Yeah.
And they're overachieving, you know, what they should be achieving in terms of the student population they have. And I mean, it was very awe-inspiring. I mean, those people are rock stars. And I mean, when I talk about the students and the administrators and the teachers, I mean, they're doing some hard work. And what I'm getting at when it comes to it being a federal issue is, again, it's like the president, it starts with the president. You know, what's the mood of the country? You know, how are we dealing with our neighbors?
What's the value of education?
All those things play into this. And if it becomes, well, we're going to get someone to run the Department of Education whose purpose in life is to make sure vouchers happen and like the public school system falls apart. And then you have a president and all those folks that sit around and talk about how we're going to go into these neighborhoods and literally terrorize people for no reason.
Yeah.
Other than just to kind of saber rattle and scare people. It's like, well, yeah, you're going to have problems in the schools because, I mean, those kids bring it to, I mean, they're dealing with that at home and they have to bring it in. And the fact that their success is a miracle.
We had this as an odds and end, but let's just talk about Oklahoma and kind of what's happening.
I've been following that a little bit, but I mean, they had the strike and I think Kentucky did the same thing.
Kentucky, West Virginia. And I think what strikes me at Oklahoma is I think it was last year they got a 17% raise in teacher pay, which the teachers will point out that's a give back from a massive cut they took at some point in time in the past. And what their point is, we're not only bringing attention to our salaries, but the money that's needed to fund the classroom.
Well, you know, the thing that, and I'm going to really pivot into a completely different place, but the thing that I have seen, and again, this goes back to, we were just talking about this before we started. You know, one of the things I've done since I decided to run like 68 days ago or whatever, I had had at the point in time, actually, I think yesterday I had my 100th one-on-one sit-down meeting with someone in the district, leader in some way, which is pretty amazing.
Everybody in the district is going to like have met you at some point the primary runs around.
You know, I got 100 meetings I've done, and I've only got 469,900 more to go to meet every registered voter in the district. But you begin to connect dots, and the thing that is really remarkable to me, and I think it plays out, I know it plays out in infrastructure, I know it's going to play out in education, and I think it plays out probably in lots of aspects of government that you do see kind of a handle on it in business, but you don't see it in government, and that is basically continuity. So, you know, like, okay, so I was talking to, I don't know if I remember talking about this in the podcast, but I was talking to an engineering firm here, and they do a lot of government contracts. And they said one of the biggest problems they have is like, you know, there's this stupid budget that never gets approved. And they do this omnibus thing that kind of keeps the government open. And they're like, they're always kind of concerned, okay, you know, if, you know, as a business owner, I'm like, okay, am I going to go out and hire a bunch of people? Like, because I don't know. Like, and if I'm an engineering company, like, you know, doing like a hangar at an airbase, you know, you don't just like go off the street, hire 10 people and go build it. Like, you got to have the architects. I mean, like, there's a long pipeline of work that has to happen. And so if you're an engineering firm, like, okay, well, if I don't have a lot of certainty about what's going to happen, it makes it hard for me to plan my business.
Absolutely.
And I think this is the problem we're having even at the state level when it comes to education. Same problem. Okay, like, if I've got a school district and I've got some funding issues or a statewide thing, like, if I don't know, like, if there's all this uncertainty about what's going to happen, it affects how I hire, it affects how I invest, and it affects how... And so it's like, just having something with some continuity kind of helps people say, okay, we understand kind of the environment we're operating in. We know the environment, and we can kind of plan. And this is going to sound like a crazy connection, but if you live out here in the Midwest, and certainly in Kansas, we always joke about the weather, how if you don't like it, it'll change in 4 hours or something like that. And haven't we been on the like roller coaster of weather?
I tell you, I don't want to go on a rant about the weather, but we talked about this before. I'm ready to fling myself off a building. If we don't get a consistent week of sunshine, I'm ready to go.
You know, we had, I mean, again, if you're not around here, like, what was it? I think it was Saturday or Friday. It was like,
it snowed.
79 degrees.
Oh yeah, on Friday.
And then on Sunday, it snowed. Yeah. And it's like, okay. And that's kind of what we're doing when it comes to how we budget and how we run our institutions and government. It's like, okay, are you wearing boots tomorrow or a long sleeve shirt? Like, you have no idea, because it's just, it's all over the place, and you can't say, okay, stop. I know for the next 4 years it's going to be like this, and now I can plan. Yeah. And I can figure out, how many people do we need? Do we need to? And so it just, I don't know. I don't know how you solve that problem.
So it's almost like the federal education department needs to become out of the political process and be a consistent across administration philosophy.
Well, I think that, I mean, the problem is whenever an administration comes in, they're going to say, okay, they're going to
put their stamp on it.
Yeah, exactly. They're not going to just kind of go with what they've had before. But I mean, I would not recommend this. Again, I'm just going totally off the top of my head, and I don't want anyone to mistake any of this as policy. But, you know, I worked at Intel, and it was kind of hard, but they had a 5-year plan. And I mean, and you know, and like they had a 5-year plan, and they were always adding to the back of that plan. They weren't changing the front of it. And so it was hard, because it was difficult to be agile at times. But you know, you can't disagree with the success of that organization and how they've been able to basically kind of, you know, almost be a, well, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to use that term, because that's the M word's a big word. But I mean, they are the dominant player in Monopoly. They're the dominant player.
I was trying to think of the M word.
Yeah, well, they're the dominant player in the microprocessor industry, and I think it's just because they're good business people. And if you looked at our education system, okay, if we had a 5-year plan that we're going to stick to, and we're only going to add to the end of it, people could actually plan.
But isn't part of the problem that the teachers are facing is that it comes across, and I'm going to play a little bit advocacy
I don't want you to go here.
I'm going
to
play a little bit on the other side. Not much, but just a little bit. If I'm sitting in Oklahoma or West Virginia, first let me say I'm absolutely for what the teachers are trying to do. But I don't like
where this is going.
If I'm playing
already.
The other side of that, why is it always money? Why your budget has only gone up? I'm not saying that it's gone up appropriate to where it should be to meet the challenges that you have, but it's always, there's only been increases. Why is it that the thing that you always need to make a difference is money? That's number one. And I think people in some ways are just exhausted with that argument that, you know, we the only thing that makes this better is more money.
Yeah, I did hear that there is a body of research in the academic environment, which, you know, I didn't do a deep dive on the validity of this research, but I was told the other day that 1% increase in funding usually results in a 1% increase in performance of kids.
Yeah.
So the more money you spend, the better the kids do. And, you know, I have to tell you, you know, the most stunning thing that you see, at least that I've been seeing, is, you know, and again, just not to do too much local geography, but you got Johnson County, which is one of the more wealthy counties in the district, or in the state.
In the state.
For that matter. And actually in the region. And then you got Wyandotte County, which is one of the poorest.
And they sit side by side.
They are side by side. I'm at this elementary school yesterday, standing in the parking lot. I'm like, hey, look, I can see Johnson County from here. And it's like, you know, 3 miles south of here, the world.
It's completely different. It's how, like, they fund, especially schools, how they fund their schools are different. Their tax base is different. How they look at education. And the point that you just made, the challenges they face are completely different. And they're 3 miles apart from each other. Those two schools.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it's, you know, I was thinking about it, not to ditch the part of town I live in, but you know, if you've ever been to Disneyland in your life, there's a sign that on the front when you walk in, it says the happiest place on earth.
That's totally not true. I just, oh my God, I despise Disneyland.
Oh really? Oh,
if I had a choice between spending 5 years in a federal prison or Disneyland, I seriously would take the prison.
We're gonna have to.
Do you know what pisses me off the most about Disney? Contrived happiness. They're creating artificial situations. I can't stand that.
Some days, Craig, I think you're kind of against happiness in general.
I think I've proven that point multiple times, haven't I?
It's not just contrived happiness, but just happiness in general.
Let's make a fake building and put a bunch of people in a fake character costume and demand that you be happy.
Oh, I think it's genuine. I think those people are happy.
Oh, those people want to kill themselves all the time, I bet.
I know people that have worked at Disneyland when they were in high school and college, and they are generally happy people.
I've been
because they worked at the happiest place on earth. Well, now, I mean, have you ever worked at the happiest place on earth?
Never. What gets me is I've been to Disneyland, and I think we went to Universal Studios. I draw no distinction between the two.
Oh, they're different.
Both,
oh,
they're both fake contrived amusement parks.
You're a hater.
I despise that place.
You're a hater if you say Disneyland and Universal Studios are the same.
They're the exact
same
thing.
They're not.
So the last point I want to make about teachers, and again, I'm not trying to get onto the bad side of our teacher crowd, but when you talk about teacher salaries and you just talk about their take-home pay, that's a bit disingenuous. But you have to throw in the retirement package and the full amount of compensation that
a
teacher reserves. Because
like
again, it's the same argument with we've gone this far, I might as well go all the way, with teachers and firemen. It's not the salary of the people on staff that is the issue. It's everybody else that doesn't teach anymore that you're paying for.
Well, there is, I mean, I did hear, so make sure everyone knows the voices here. So that was Craig talking about
how he
hates on teachers.
And no, that's not me hating on teachers. That's me taking a realistic view to maybe what some of the issues are. And I'll give you an example. I'm from Missouri. Missouri has one of the top retirement benefits, I believe, in the country. You get...
For teachers.
They average out your top 3 years as a teacher, and you get 80% of that for the rest of your life.
Holy mackerel.
That is a benefit that when you talk about the overall compensation of the teacher and what it takes to pay and what teacher pay is, you have to put that in.
Well, and I'll just take a more macro view of that just to make it, well, what you are saying is that by having those types of benefits, ultimately the budget for education now is distorted
completely different
about retirement and administration and not about
absolutely and
books and teachers and classrooms.
And I'm not making the point that teachers are compensated adequately or fairly. That's not the point I'm trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is if this is an economic argument about salary, you've got to look at a much wider scope to what that salary is. Because if you're having trouble, if you want to increase the pool of money to pay teachers, which I think all of us do, in some ways, that's always going to be problematic.
Well, and you can have this. I mean, I hear that this is one of the big. I mean, this is a big problem with the federal budget as well, is like the albatross of pensions.
Absolutely.
And entitlement
Absolutely.
Programs. And I mean, it's entitlement, like Social Security as well. You know, people live longer and all these things, and so it's just
I remember an interview with the police commissioner for New York and talking about the budget for his department.
Same problem.
And he's like, "Hold up, guys! It's not the policemen on the staff today that are causing the problem." It's the people that haven't worked here for 20 years that we're still drawing.
And you could argue part of this, that's a symptom of the mentality that lots of folks in government have, which is kick it down the hill. Like, okay, I'm not going to solve this problem now. I'm just going to kick it down the hill.
And that's a really hard conversation to have, right? Hey, listen, I get it that we need to pay more and we need to be more competitive to attract better folks into teaching.
But we'll have a better pension plan for people and then folks will agree to that. And that just kicks the problem down the hill.
And I think, too, so here's the pool of money that we have. It's controlled by the state. It's a tax situation. Everybody knows the difficulties in increasing the pool. One of the things we can do is manipulate each side of the pool. If you want more here, you have to take away from your back end.
Yeah.
It's and I'm again, I am not, I don't want to come across as those teachers are wrong. I think they're absolutely right to do what they're doing. The fact that they have textbooks that are 30 years old, half broken seats, 80 kids in a class, that's ridiculous. And we should do something about it. But if we're going to talk about, if we're going to make compensation the main issue, we've got to take the full breadth of what teacher compensation is.
And I'll tell you, I mean, I was really impressed with the teachers I met with, well, I've met with over the last couple months. You know, and I will admit some of the people I met even recently are they're in their second career. So the one person that I know very well, you know, he had had a career, you know, into his 50s and then decided he was going to go and teach towards the end of his career because he just wanted to do the, he just wanted to do it. You know, he felt like it was a good way to get back to the community and kind of help his, you know, neighbor and all that kind of stuff. So I have a great deal of admiration for what those folks face every day and what they're trying to accomplish. I can't say enough complimentary things about what you're trying to do.
So let's switch to some national stuff here before I say more things about teachers and firemen that get me in trouble.
Every bad thing that was said about teachers, Craig said.
Maybe I'll throw in ambulance drivers and other folks in there just to offend the entire segment.
Do you want to bash on my son who's a teacher in the Peace Corps? I mean, can you find something wrong with that?
Throw a few kicks at him while he's down too.
He's been sick for the last couple of weeks.
I don't know if it's the cold has nothing to do.
This is the kid overseas. Yeah.
Did he catch something? Some sort of virus or something?
Well, they're saying that he probably had some tainted water. All right. So let's. You know, I'll tell you. You know, we kind of talked about before we started this. So if you want to talk about Comey or. I always what's the name of the crazy lawyer that defends all the bad people in the world?
Michael Cohen, fixer.
Yeah, the fixer. You know, we were talking about this before we started, and I'm like, I think the shit show is kind of really getting to the point where I am honestly getting tired and paying less attention to the theater of every week. There's some new zig and zag in the. Awfulness of Donald Trump and all this kind of stuff.
We're just rehashing the same stuff at this point.
It's basically the same story. It's just
the same story.
I don't know. I wish I could think of a good analogy.
Well, we talked about Comey, and the note that I wrote down was, "What's the point? I don't get it." He thinks Donald Trump doesn't have the moral compass to be president of the United States. He thinks Donald Trump has a problem with women. He thinks Donald Trump lies all the time. I was waiting for Comey to say, and another discovery is water was found to be wet. What are we talking about? You're rehashing stuff that we've known for a decade on
Trump.
Well,
and the thing, and you and I talked about this too. I mean, the thing that's driving me a little nuts is there's kind of this narrative that plays out on a lot of the news programs that are on the, you know, that tend to be either objective or more liberal. They just keep acting like, okay, the way we're going to pitch this story to get you to watch the commercial break is now we finally have something.
Absolutely.
And now this is going to finally end.
Absolutely.
And it's like, it literally is the boy who cried wolf. I mean, it's like no.
The only thing that changes the game is the discovery of potential criminal activity.
Right.
The fact that Trump has moral problems on multiple fronts has already been litigated.
Well, we knew about that before the election.
That's a huge nothing. If he survived the 16 or 19 women that have come out and accused him of sexual assault or inappropriate behavior, if he survived the Access Hollywood tape, there's nothing left to talk about in that area.
Yeah, it's
if you watch Comey, he just came across as this smug, sanctimonious.
Wow, you are in hate mode.
Awful. And again, what really
finish your Red Bull. You've got some problems.
What rankled me most about Comey is his complete defense of his handling around the Hillary Clinton announcement 11 days before the election.
Now, I do have some empathy for him that, like, it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of scenario.
I completely disagree with that. Follow the regs of the DOJ. You don't say nothing until you look at the laptop and you find there's nothing there. Then you don't talk about it.
This was pretty easy.
And again, how do you come out and reignite the investigation
email.
Of Hillary's email? At the same time, Trump's under federal investigation, and you never mentioned that.
Yeah.
I loved when, was it Stephanopoulos? Yeah, I struggle with people's names constantly. But when he basically told him, Nate Silver at 538 basically ran some numbers. And just to let you know, you pretty much directly had an impact on this election.
Right.
Your actions will go down in history as, and his complete, I was more worried about the moral character of the issue. So it's like, give me a break.
Well, you know, it's, sometimes I need to have my, when I'm watching those interviews, and it's really awful to say this, but the hour that I've invested in watching the interviews, I decided to watch Colbert because I needed to have
get better info out of it.
Well, I wanted to have fries with my hamburger. You know, I wanted to have something better than just kind of a interview. Every interviewer is going to have some level of not being objective. I mean, and Stephanopoulos obviously has, you know, obvious history.
Yeah.
And Colbert does too. I mean, it's not like he's some diehard Republican. So I thought it was a good interview on Colbert. I mean, I watched it and it was good.
Well, the other thing too is that if you're writing the book, the synopsis of this book is James Comey claims the moral high ground. That's really what this is about.
Yeah.
These were moral and ethical issues. If you're claiming the moral high ground on Trump, why throw the quotes in there about his hands are small, his tie's too long, and he's orange with tanning goggle lines around his face?
Well, they
why take the personal swipe?
Well, they talked about that on Colbert. Did you watch that interview?
I didn't.
Yeah, it was one paragraph in the whole book, and so they were both of them. Both Colbert and Comey were critical of the fact that, well, this is just kind of like someone just random doesn't read the book and just pulls out something to bitch about when it's one paragraph in the whole book.
I totally understand that, but you have to know that's going to happen.
You just leave it.
If it's
just leave
one
it out.
Paragraph, just leave drop it, out. It.
Yeah.
Why put it in? I thought Comey, I'm done with Comey just needs to go away.
So
no book tour, no movie. You know, he's already signed like a movie rights
deal.
Has
he really?
That's going to be awful. This is a complete cash in by him. This is not an attempt to save his reputation.
Well, so but this couldn't the story go the same path of, and I've now already forgot the guy's name. Was it Sean Spicer? Was he the guy who was the secretary?
Yes.
The communications
Spicy.
I mean, Spicy tried to do the same kind of narrative, and he's kind of like faded from, or at least maybe I don't watch Fox, and he's like a commentator there, but now
he pops up occasionally. But when you're,
well, he was going to do like the book deal, book tour,
Spicy
he kind of vanished after about 6 months.
Was that if your claim to fame is how well you lie, your shtick fades really fast.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's why Comey's talking about leadership and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, and how moral it was for, come on, that was a total straight up political decision. You made a calculus. And then to come out and say, well, I only released it because she was 11 points up and I thought she was going to win.
Well, I didn't hear that part of it.
I mean, it was, I found it to be ridiculous. That whole story's run its course.
I think you're still feeling the burn from the 16 election.
Well, it's like the Stormy Daniels interview. Same thing. Great. She just got on for an hour and recounted, just regurgitated information that everybody
knew. And that story just doesn't die. I mean, like, she showed up at some, I don't even know, I think she, like, had lunch at Panera and it was on TV or something.
She was
like,
at Cohn's. Cohn got, Michael Cohn, the lawyer for Trump, the fixer, the Ray Donovan, the mob, you know, the mob enforcer, Sammy the Bull, whatever he wants to call himself. He was put in court Monday. Yeah, Monday. And she showed up at the at court. And I think what you probably
for
saw
what
was
purpose?
Just to be there, just to be on camera and to give a statement afterwards. Just to keep her high profile high, her face on TV and her lawyer doing interviews. Which I think that's a lot of what this has deteriorated into at this point.
Well, at the end of the day, if you're a lawyer, you get paid by the client for your time. So the lawyers always have a vested interest in prolonging the case, if that makes any sense.
So Michael Cohn has been Trump's personal lawyer, fixer, confidant, consigliere, whatever you want to call it, for I think like the past 10 or 12, 15-ish years.
Yeah, he runs with some interesting people.
I read something about Trump, and the one thing that people I think don't realize about his business, really for the past 20 years, the reason he's had to go to Russia and he's done all these deals overseas, no legitimate business in the United States will lend him money or touch him or get in bed with him in a business situation anymore because he's burned so many people to the ground.
Well, and I have had the opportunity. I know some folks that are originally from the New York area and had lived there during the time when Trump was like in his ascent. And universally, those people hate him. I mean, universally, because they have some personal story or some secondhand story about how he screwed somebody over.
Yeah,
and it's just like he's just not a good person. You know, he's exactly kind of all the things that lots of folks around the country hate about people from New York is that they've had every opportunity. They were born with a silver spoon in their mouth. They've had every single opportunity. And they want to sit around and complain about how they're not getting a good deal.
So Cohn has been under investigation apparently for like 2 months.
Right.
It was a referral. I think the Mueller referred it to the Southern District of New York.
Right. Because
to say this is a criminal investigation.
Yeah. Wasn't it because of this like campaign finance fraud?
Because
they didn't report the $130,000.
I think that's the spark that kind of lit all of this up.
This is the mail fraud problem that they got.
And at the end, it was Rod Rosenstein approved the raid on his office. Mm-hmm. And something that's been really interesting, the legal bar you have to get over to actually raid a lawyer's office and confiscate materials between him and a client is really, really high.
Wow.
I think, too, that it's interesting, and this is just coming from watching way too much of this and following it really close. There in the federal justice and court system, there is specific language around who is a subject and who is a target of an investigation.
Right.
A target of an investigation basically means we plan to charge you.
Oh, wow.
So Michael Cohn is the target of a federal investigation. They think, again, it might take 30, 60 days, but the expected outcome of a target is that you are officially charged. So how they've languaged up and what they've already done with Cohn, he is going to face a federal indictment.
So, you know, let's take a macro view of this real quick, because like we were talking about earlier, the thing that's kind of a bummer, well, the thing I hate about this right now is like it seems like the news channels like every day want to get through the cliffhanger of the commercials is like, okay, breaking news is going to finally all be end at this point. But at a macro level, and it's more of a philosophical question, do you think there's always this much corruption and bad behavior? It's just that we don't see it, or do you think this is different?
This is different. Obama never had a personal fixer.
Yeah.
Bush never had a personal fixer. Obama, Bush, Clinton, they never did business overseas.
At the scale because of the business empire that you're trying to run and finance.
And sketchy overseas. It's like, hey, the top tier legitimate banks and business people won't deal with me anymore. So I'm going down to this overseas underlayer.
Yeah,
that's where I'm
the oligarchs and all that kind of stuff.
I think this is all new. I don't think this is politics as usual, but I do agree with you. I'm tired of the breaking news alerts. I'm tired of anytime anybody has a rehash of something that we it's presented as this moves this case significantly down the road. And probably everybody, we should ban all news of this until Mueller comes out and says, I'm done. And then
not to go back to, horse and buggy times, but, back in those days, it took a lot of time, money, and effort to get ink on paper.
Yeah.
And a whole lot of, and now, oh my God, we're a cable news network and we got 24 hours we got to fill. Well, so, we have to have something.
One breaking news big thing last week was Michael Cohn may have recorded conversations. Okay. Or he may not have.
And there's another new development today.
In another new development, there's a possibility that maybe somebody could have done something. And that's what we're kind of passing off as things that further the story. And I think everybody's just about at the limit of their consumption of this story.
Yeah, I was going to take a quick look at what'd you think about Barbara Bush, by the way? We didn't even talk about that today.
I think Barbara Bush lived a fantastic life. I think she got everything she could into those 92 years. By all accounts, Barbara Bush kind of ran that Bush family, kept everybody in line, kept everybody kind of marching forward. I've never heard a single person say a bad word about her.
Yeah.
I watched some video clips of her and George, her husband, former president, of course, reading letters they'd written to each other in the 40s and when he was at war.
Right,
he's in the Second World War. Absolutely. Yep, everybody should have a marriage like those two. Yeah. I mean, if you don't like Republicans, you don't like Bush, so be it. But if you take that off and look at those two people, what they've done, the types of human beings they are, the families that they've raised, that's something everybody should aspire to.
Just got to salute that.
And I like to, and I don't know what the right way to say this to, but she kind of, I think, did it correctly at the end. I mean, she reached a point where she realized,
yeah,
this is the inevitable outcome. I've lived a great life. I've left a great legacy. I'm not going to maybe stretch this out in some way. And I'm not saying this correctly, but I think all of us aspire to wish that we have that choice. We have that, our faculties at that time. We make that choice, yeah, and we end it with the family, maybe the way that she did.
Yeah, and we faced this with my wife's mother, Susie, and the circumstances were different, all those kinds of things, but it is you do have some, you do feel good in the fact that people can kind of do that on their own terms.
I ran my race, I did everything I wanted to, and I'm going to end this in the way that reflects the values that I live my life with.
I was trying to I went on to news just because I wanted to see if there was any breaking news about this to kind of confirm my point, but unfortunately it just said that, is it Pompeo? What's the guy's name? The CIA director?
Pompeo,
yeah. Kansas guy, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't know how he's qualified to do that, but he made a secret visit to North Korea. That's the other thing that's on the top of the news today. Holy crap. There's a picture of a plane on Southwest Airlines that had the engine.
How frightening is that? The engine blows. It breaks out the window. Apparently, this poor woman got partially sucked out this window, and that's what caused her injuries to die.
Oh, right. I didn't know there was a fatality.
Yeah, there was a fatality, but that's just, I mean, how many times have you sat on a plane looking at the wing of that engine saying, I wonder how that thing really works? I don't want to get into another airline rant like we went on last time, but
I don't remember that rant, but
we went for like 20 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Horrible airlines.
I love airlines. I guess I do remember we did talk about that.
Getting on an airline and flying to Disney is like the worst possible thing on the planet.
So you're saying that you don't enjoy the trip and you don't enjoy the destination?
No.
Yeah.
I look forward to when my kids have kids and they're like, you know, because we took grandma to Disney with us.
Right.
And they're like, come on, guys, come to Disney with us and you can help us with the kids and stuff. I'm like, you know, I'm going to be a huge a-hole for like 5 days if you drag me to Disney. I'll go just because I want to spend some of your money because I'm not paying for this myself.
Exactly. All right. Real quick. So as we start to wind down, so you had brought up the story this morning, which I had not read yet, is this story about Charlie Dent. I think it's kind of interesting for folks that listen to the pod.
So Charlie Dent is a 14-year congressman out of PA. His district is the Philadelphia suburbs. He had announced earlier in the year that he was not going to seek re-election. And then this week, he just came out and said, you know what? I'm done in May. I'm going to get out of here early. And I listened to an interview with him on MSNBC, cite the source. And it was interesting that they asked him, why do this? Because now the governor's got to make a decision about a special election.
Yeah, well, piss elections are a pain in the butt.
Yeah, they're just a huge pain. So why not just hang out? And the first thing he said was, you know, number one, In an election year, in the summer, for the next 6 months, we're going to do nothing. And he's like, and that's not like hyperbole, like we're going to do a little. We're going to do nothing.
You mean, when you say we, you mean like Congress?
Congress.
Because we're going to be in an election cycle.
Absolutely. We're in an election cycle. Everybody has got other things to do. They've got other worries, other concerns.
And probably every vote they take is really just to kind of lay groundwork
absolutely
for messaging in the fall.
It's all for something that's going to map back to your district. So he's like, we're not going to accomplish or do much in the next 6 months. So it's not like I'm leaving at a time when there's a lot going on. Secondly, he's like, you know, I've made no bones that I don't really like the president. I don't get along with the president.
This is a Republican, right?
This is a Republican. And he's like, I don't want to spend the next 6 months talking about his tweets, which are only, as the Mueller investigation slogs on and the midterms come up, are only going to get worse. He's like, I just don't want to spend my last 6 months in Congress basically being put into the position to where I have to defend Donald Trump or defend the position of why I've chose not to defend Donald Trump. And then the third thing, and I thought this was really interesting, and the interviewer kind of led to this question, but they talk about Article 1 of the Constitution, separation of powers, and they got on to what does the U.S. Congress actually do these days?
Well, and you talked about this earlier, but I mean, maybe the better question is what does the U.S. Congress accomplish?
What do we actually get done? And he brought up the point, we don't do budgets anymore, which was one of our primary powers, the powers of the purse string. And he's like, you know, we passed this horrifying omnibus bill that nobody knows what it is. It was written by aides and
lobbyists.
And lobbyists. Nobody knows what it is, but we just had to do something to keep the government open and the military funding. So we did it. So we don't really go about the business of budgeting for the American people and budgeting for our priorities.
Right.
And he's like, second, too, we don't use Congress to declare war anymore. He's like, that is another one of the primary powers given to the Congress because, again, of their close connection to the people, we've just been in an endless state of war that we've never had a debate on, and we've just taken that power away from this legislation body. And he's like, that's wrong. That's completely not how this is supposed to work. And then the third thing he said, which I thought was really interesting, is we don't really legislate anymore. We don't tackle anything that has a side to it that has a political downside. Abortion, gun rights, pick one.
We got internet privacy was like the big story.
Internet privacy. He's like, we've given that ground up because politically we don't want to touch it because we're afraid of what it's going to do back home. And we've given that all up to executive order.
Right.
And the conclusion that he came to is, As a congressman, and this was him and the reporter kind of talking it out. So I don't want to attribute this next line to Representative Dent, but it's like really you're a pundit for your side. That's really what your main job is. Mm-hmm. Your job is to get out and to politic and to stump and to get on the cable news and promote your side. That's really what he's doing. And he made it kind of very clear. I've got other things to do. I've got some other opportunities to chase down. I get it, PA. You're going to get mad at me because this special election, you're going to have to make a decision and all of that stuff. But at the end of the day, I don't want to waste 6 more months here. I'm gone. And I thought it was very interesting to hear him kind of tick down. What is it that is, to your point, what is the goal to accomplish while you're there? And what powers has Congress specifically given up simply because they won't, or they don't want to touch it?
Yeah, and you know, and are you trying to talk me out of running? Is that what you're trying to do?
I'm not trying to do that at all.
Well, you know, I think that, I'm reacting to this kind of in real time, which is dangerous, but it seems like his assessment would be, I can't find a flaw in his assessment. I mean, I think that there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm one of those kind of people, too, and just in terms of my personal life. Well, I'm not always great at that, or even in my professional life. But I do believe that, like, if you don't like something, you need to take some responsibility for fixing it. And I'm not talking about him individually. I'm talking about Congress.
Yeah.
In whole. Like, if you don't like the way this is going, then like you need to like take it back.
Well,
they make laws. I mean, if they want to make a law about how executive orders go down, they can do that.
And his point was, I'm a policy wonk. I get into policy. I ran for Congress to make better policy and better law.
Right.
And he's like, we've given up so much of that in this body that we just don't do anymore. He's like, if that's your thing, if that's what you want to do, there's just not a lot. A lot of that's gone.
Well, so I'll be a little critical of him. Like again, this was one of the many moments I had as I was considering running, is okay. So it's a mess, and it's screwed up, and it's broken. So I can either go, you know, take my bike and go play someplace in a different part of the neighborhood, or I can stand my ground and say, like, we're going to fix this.
I have a core rule. If you bang your face on a brick wall, don't tell me how bad your face hurts. There are times in life when you take your ball and you move on.
Yeah.
Because you can ram that wall all you want. And I think you have to have enough awareness sometimes. And I apply this mostly to work. When you know that wall ain't moving.
Well, and, you know, and I'll tell you what, I'll be a little, I agree with you that, you know, at times, like, it's the whole, like, you know, if you do the same thing, why should you, you know, expect different results? I agree with that. But I do think the analogy of business and comparing it to government is a little different. Because, you know, businesses are not legislated into perpetuity, you know, to benefit a society. Businesses are designed to basically make money for a set of shareholders. And like, it's a wholly different kind of like view of the world. And like, it's not a proposition of something that's going to be around for a long time. And if these institutions, if we don't find a way to get them functioning eventually it leads to the downfall of the Republic, which is very different than if one small software company goes out of business because they're making bad businesses.
So let me ask you a question. You can answer this or not.
Well, I sound like a philosopher there. Like I was not quite Thomas Jefferson.
You were waxing philosophical there. I'm not sure does waxing mean thinking or talking?
I don't know. I mean, to talk about the downfall of the Republic, if you talk about, the, you know, if you
I
use
thought
the
you
word,
were going straight Caesar on me at some point.
If you use the word Republic, it sounds so much more.
It does.
Like, I don't know.
It sounds like a different level. I understand this at a level that you don't. It worked the other day. We talked about our smarty pants words. That there are certain words that you use when you're just trying to be Mr. Smarty Pants.
What's one of your smarty pants words?
Here's a good one. Germane.
Germane.
Mike, I'm sorry in this meeting, but that topic really isn't germane to the problem at hand.
Would you use the word leverage? Would that be another one
no,
of those words?
No, it's got to be a word that people have never really heard before or don't hear a lot in conversation is a smarty pants word.
Wait, and by the way, just to kind of just throw them under the bus, we talked about this. This is one of the inspirations for this podcast. Part of the problem we had...
Smarty pants words?
Exactly. Well, misogynistic. And I told you like...
I don't know what that means.
Exactly. We were talking
I
about...
I think I know what it means.
Well, I think I know what it means now. But like nobody that's from part of town I'm from, if you were to kind of...
What does xenophobic mean?
I don't know.
I still don't know that.
Well, it's like, isn't that the fear of people that are different than you or something like that?
I thought it was like fear of other religions. I'm probably making that up.
Well, the point is that those are smarty pants terms.
They're smarty pants terms.
Yeah. Out here, you just call that person a bigot.
Absolutely.
Or an asshole or something like that.
So, okay. So here's my question. Don't answer if you don't want to.
I won't. I plead the fifth.
You're running for... You get to Congress the first day.
The first day.
Would you raise your hand and say, hey, that Hastert rule, that rule of the majority of the majority, I'm going to put a... We got to dump that. We got to get rid of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one. Number two, what about voting for Pelosi for leader?
You know, I've had that question asked me on the campaign trail, and I think it's kind of a dumb question.
Why is that a dumb question? She's the leader of the face of that body for the Democratic Party, and nothing happens without her personal approval.
You know, I'm trying to navigate my way and learn how to campaign to get out of a primary. And then I'll have to learn how to get out of a general election.
Yeah.
And then when I have an opportunity, I would love to meet Nancy Pelosi and all the other folks that might want to be Speaker of the House and decide who I would vote for. But I have no idea. I don't know her politics. I know that she's older, you know, maybe kind of she's kind of lost a step in terms of her leadership. But you know, I think it's anyone, you know, and she gets reelected every 2 years too. I mean, she may not be there. I mean, I doubt that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying though.
She's pretty solid. That's a possibility. Absolutely.
So it's like, you know, let's talk about, and again, this will be more of a business mind. Like, let's talk about the things we can control now. And then when we get to a place where we need to have that discussion, then we'll figure that out when we get there. I'm not trying to skirt it. I'm just being pragmatic. Like, I don't know if I would say yes or no because I haven't studied it yet.
So it's always interesting where, how do you take a pragmatic approach and when do you realize you're banging your face on a wall that's never going to move? And I think if you take back to business experience, mm-hmm. there's all times all of us have pulled the plug on a job when we've said, well, that's it. There's no movement here. There's impediments that just aren't going to move. So what really am I doing?
Most people, I don't know about you, but I mean, for me, well, I shouldn't say that. I guess there have been times where I've been pretty impatient, and I can just see that it's an unmovable object.
But there's a difference between patience and immovability. I think those are two totally, and I think how things that are immovable are parsed to people as have patience is one. I guess this is where I'm kind of millennial in Generation Z. If somebody tells me be patient, no. It's right or it's wrong. It's changing or it's not changing. Make your mind up what you want to do and let's go. Patience is a code word for I'm not listening. I don't care. It's not going to happen.
Well, I think there are times that are like that. But I do think that, you know, things, not everything. Well, I used to have this conversation with a couple of my bosses in the past. Like, you know, not everything can happen all at one time.
If you choose not to do it, sure.
Right. So the goal is to just, okay, what do we need? You know, what's the most important thing we can work on now that's going to get us further down that road, you know, for tomorrow? And, you know, and because you can't do everything all at once. Now, I will tell you the one other thing that I've been thinking about, and I think it does really play into some of the roles I've had in my professional life, and I think it's also a learning that could be used in Congress, is, you know, there's the legislative process, which is getting laws done and, like, all that kind of, like, you know, the meat and potatoes of this.
Yeah.
But And we did this at Bluetooth. You know, that's the meat and potatoes, the specification and blah, 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 like the legislative side of that organization. But there was the evangelical side of what you did in that role, which was to kind of like lay the groundwork to make the legislative process easy.
Yeah.
So the idea is, okay, if you can get out and get people believing that there's going to be a technology that's going to connect all these devices and it's going to be easy to use and it's going to be this euphoria of a world without wires.
Sure.
If you can get people believing that, the legislative process is easier because people want to believe that there's going to be a future. This is maybe the biggest role for the president, and one of the reasons why it's such a mess right now. And by the way, also for Congress, is like, help us like believe what this is going to be. That's in a positive, you know, that's a positive thing about the future, as opposed to just like, hey, you know, just decided to bomb Syria today, or like no plan. And it's like, you know, without having the, again, so we keep focusing back on this kind of legislative piece of it, and more, maybe it's more on this evangelical side. And I don't mean that like from a religious point, but I mean from in the tech sector, evangelism is basically, you know, kind of telling people what the future might look like and getting them excited about the future.
I guess I'm trying to kind of connect more with the younger crowd, but you know, I'm looking for my trigger events at this point in time. And I guess I've been reading more about that, and there are certain things as you start to recognize that.
But what
is code language for something?
Yeah.
That means I'm not listening. I don't care. That's not going to change. And I think again, this gets back to this guy, you know, Representative Dent leaving Congress to wrap up. I think he just kind of saw. Wait a minute. Nothing's changing. The processes of the institution are starting to evolve to become more static.
Right.
We are willingly giving up legislative authority every chance we get, and we are divorcing ourselves from the main responsibilities that this body was created. And he just said, I don't need it for another 6 months. I got better stuff to do.
Well, hopefully his actions will lead to some change. You know, I think I think it's a very candid assessment of kind of how he sees, you know, Congress.
So. I was surprised at how he's just like, I hate every day talking about what Trump said, did, or
well, I agree
I'm just
with
tired
that.
Of it. Just don't
agree
talk
with that.
About it anymore.
Well, I mean, I've, you know, to wrap this up, one, I've told this to a number of folks as I've been, you know, out. And what I tell them is that, you know, all of us have our personal narratives of how we've like faced and overcome adversity in our lives. All of us do. Okay. And we should celebrate those stories. And, you know, I have them and the other candidates do. And, you know, the people you meet with, the voters, have the same things. But what I tell them, I said, you know, the thing that we need to remember, and I tell them that, you know, like when I was at Water.org, one of the things I learned is that, you know, hey, what, we're pretty lucky that we were born or we live in this country.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, like we can do anything that our country, I mean, anything that we want to do, we can do it. We have the resources, we have the money, we have the intellect. If we chose to do something, we could actually do anything we want. But the thing that's frustrating is that our leaders, a lot of them, and this goes back to what Representative Dent's talking about, a lot of our leaders basically spend all their time angling to get on the Sunday morning talk programs.
You're a pundit.
To talk about what some grumpy old man's posting on Twitter. And it's like, okay, is that, again, to use the fancy term, is this the end of the republic?
It's a smarty pants word.
Exactly. Is that how this is going to go down? And for me, I want to be hopeful that, okay, people can see that this is awful and we don't like it. And we want to have, you know, this more perfect union, and we just need to figure out how to do that. And we need good people to run, and we need good people to support the good people that are running, that are focused on trying to fix things and not just trying to get a career or, you know, whatever the case might be.
You've learned this from working in technology as long as you have. The number one thing you fight is we can do anything. That is the death knell to you. Because if you don't focus on one thing,
yeah, I agree with that.
A thing, you do nothing.
Right. It goes back to the, you know, the most important decisions you make in business are the things you say no to.
The things you say no. And you have to get into the practice of saying no.
Right.
And I think if you apply that to government, that's where some of this, I think that's the sideshow.
Right.
The sideshow of we can do a lot keeps us all buzzing and thinking about what we can do instead of saying, the logical starting point to improve the greatest number of people's situation is X, and right. We're going to work on X. I feel like we never get to that point of saying we can do so
much.
No,
and I'll tell you what.
Here's what we're going to do.
And you know, and I, you know, I'm sure this audience is going to be pretty sympathetic to this view. But I mean, I'll give the Obama's administration some credit. I mean, they were flawed in their own ways too. But for a sustained period of time, they focused on trying to fix healthcare.
Yeah,
and you know,
they pushed it through,
and it wasn't perfect.
Right or wrong,
you know, it wasn't perfect, and there was things they could have done better. But there was a sustained, deliberate, coordinated, month-long, year-long effort to have a process, to have a conversation, to get people talking about ideas. And
think of that and put it in the context of our current administration. What could they hold focus on for 18 months for that level?
No, they can't keep focus for more than 18 hours on something. So it just goes from, you know, from fire to fire to fire.
This is what drives me crazy. So we're going to focus on the magic of America that we can do anything while we get absolutely nothing done.
Yeah, it is.
That's
kind of
the cycle. It somewhat drives me nutty because I've been a grouchy old man rant all pod. Might as well just continue it. I can't stand it. When people get up there and their primary theme is, we can do anything, sit down. Unless you have a specific plan, action steps, and a way to get us there, I'm tired of the conversation.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast, and be sure to subscribe through your favorite store. Visit our website, the2minintheMiddle.com, for historical episodes and more about the podcast. Likewise, you can find us on Twitter at the2minintheMiddle for show updates and upcoming episodes. Thanks for stopping by and have a great week.